direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe. Direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe. It's the Raleigh James Show.
James Show. In a minute, you're about to meet Lou Irwin. And I got to tell you, it's not often that I say that it's absolutely a privilege to get to talk with somebody, but in this hour, it sure will be. If you're from California, you'll remember Lou from KBC TV when he was there on television. Or maybe if you're a fan of comedy from the 60s or an Angelino who remembers listening to KRLA, you'll remember him from The Credibility Gap and his work there and virtually half the radio stations in Los Angeles. But it was later, actually, that I first got hooked on Lou. It was 1972 when I first heard Earth News Radio. And bottom line to this was I would listen to radio stations I otherwise did not like, and I meant that musically, just to hear this feature. It was terrific. And I later learned that not only was Lou the voice and the research and all the work we heard on the air, but he was behind the scenes as well. And my admiration really grew because at that point in time, the only way you were ever going to hear anything that was remotely bartered on the radio was it'd be a network product. Well, this wasn't. So in some ways, you could say that Lou really sparked independent radio syndication, the idea of bringing barter back to a point of prominence where it had been until the 50s. However, he might have topped himself on that too, because he sent me a copy of Deadly Times. And the first thing I noticed was I was completely unaware that the Los Angeles Times building was bombed. I mean, with deaths and major destruction in 1910. Not only that, I was unaware of the role of Clarence Darrow. This was, in many ways, the trial of the century, if you will. But more to the point, it was a decade of unprecedented terror. And as I looked further at this, being an Angelino, I'm saying, why didn't they teach me this in school? Because it just never came up. But it had implications in every sphere, not only journalism, obviously, not only unions, and we'll get into that, and the growth of unionization to that point, political, very much so. But as I read this book, and it was fascinating to me because it's not written like a history book. It truly is a story, and you will love Deadly Times. I've got a link at Raleigh.net. The thing that saddened me over and over, and Lou had pointed this out, so I was ready for it, is there are no heroes in this story. You know, normally the stories that we love have a good guy and a bad guy, you know, both sides. Nobody's clean in this. This is a obviously the bombing was a heinous thing, but beyond that, looking for you know, the real white knights, they're not in this story. And that makes it even more fascinating. So I want to welcome Lou Irwin to the Raleigh James Show. Thanks for joining us, Lou.
Well, thanks for all those kind words.
Oh, well, it's also so true. And we have something in common, which you might not know, because you were there in its glory days, and I was program director later of KPOL. So we share.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. I was there. Cap Cities owned it at the time. And late the latter 70s, you betcha. And even then, I would listen to you on Earth News Radio.
And I was there when it was owned by a guy named Hugh Murchison.
Right.
And KPOL stood for Polka.
Yes.
It was the only polka radio station in Los Angeles.
Yes, yes. I referred to it many times because, as I say, we were on the declining years, and Cap Cities would have sold it if they could have passed a proof of performance, but they couldn't. So I said, well, it was once Radio Polka, now it's Radio Poland. We're a mess. And indeed we were. So this is really a wonderful book, Deadly Times, which, you know, it's interesting, as I thought about it, those of us who are relatively contemporary radio or television people, you will go down forever for your work with the Credibility Gap or Earth News Radio. But I think long after we're gone, Deadly Times may turn out to be your legacy. This is, without a doubt, the most unreported story in modern day that I've ever run across.
I agree. I had no idea that that there had been a bombing when I began writing it. It was all a revelation to me, too.
And that's so odd. So to set the scene, and I hope everybody will take the time to buy a copy of this and read it. It is a quick read and a fun read because you bring these characters to life. From the beginning, I decided I hated some of them, and I just, you know, I felt sorry for some of them. You got me into their personalities, which is a wonderful thing here. But in short, if you had to sum it up, what precipitated the bombing of the Los Angeles Times?
Well, the Los Angeles Times was the voice of Los Angeles at that time. And Los Angeles was an open shop city, competing with San Francisco, which was a closed shop city. Los Angeles grew by leaps and bounds in the first decade of the century. I mean, in 1900, it was so about 80,000 people. By 1910, it was over 300,000. San Francisco was about 300,000 in 1900 and about 300,000 in 1910. And they were losing population, and primarily because people who were entrepreneurs and trying to start businesses in California were going to Los Angeles because labor was cheap. And the businessmen in San Francisco put up an ultimatum to the unions there and said, you know, either Los Angeles becomes, you pay the same amount of money in Los Angeles or you pay the same amount of money in San Francisco. And you here either deunionize or Los Angeles unionizes. Well, you know what happened. The effort was stepped up by the San Francisco people to unionize Los Angeles. And they were unsuccessful. So they called in a union in Indianapolis, the Iron Workers Union, which had great success all over the country, raising union wages and benefits by bombing contractors that were reluctant to sign up with them. And
I was going to say, alarmingly so. That was something that when I first started reading about Ordy McManigal and what he was bombing, it was stunning to me that here he would bomb a bridge or a facility and they'd say, okay, well, we'll unionize now. I mean, that level of fear stunned me. Did that surprise you?
Oh, yes. I mean, who would have thought that the great American Federation of Labor, AFL, would have had unions engaging in this kind of terror. I had no idea that this sort of thing was going on back 100 years ago.
Well, I was not surprised by their tactics, frankly. What I was surprised at is how easy their adversaries rolled over. You would normally think one bomb like that and people would become more resolute over my dead body, I will. But it seems like the decisions in many of these cases, and you chronicled this so well in Deadly Times, so it's not that you're skirting over the facts, these people just fell all over themselves after they were attacked to say, sure, we'll sign up tomorrow.
Well, yes. I mean, it costs them sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, which would be millions of dollars these days.
Yeah. So don't mean to interrupt. Here we are. They went to Indianapolis. They're gonna get some outside labor and continue.
Well, they went to the union in Indianapolis. They sent out a couple of guys, Artie McManigle and J.B. McNamara, who was the brother of the guy who assigned all the bombings on the East Coast, J.J. McNamara. They came to California, got the dynamite, went to Los Angeles. J.B. McNamara planted the bombs in the Times building, went to the home of the owner of the Times, planted a bomb over there, went to the home of the head of the Merchants and Manufacturers Association, planted another bomb over there, and took off on a train back to San Francisco to collect his money for doing his job. It was really that simple. The two bombs that were planted at the homes didn't go off because of a faulty mechanism. The Times bomb did. J.B. McNamara went to the basement of the Times, opened up all the gas jets to make sure that the bomb was as effective as possible, and killed 20 people and injured over 100. And it, to this day, remains the deadliest crime ever committed in the history of California.
And again, a shock that this didn't reverberate for decades and decades and decades. It certainly cost one man his mayoral race. It turned, as you so eloquently put it throughout the pages, it really turned the union sentiment away from the worker, really, until the Great Depression. It had lasting impact, but today it's barely a footnote. And that is just astounding to me that it didn't follow through. Now, of course, if Chandler or Otis were alive to read the L.A. Times today, they might wonder if any of it was worth it. But where it was back then was really not only, you know, the trial of the century, the crime of the century, but sociological. This was a turning point in American history.
Oh, absolutely. No, the American labor movement was weakened to the point of almost non-existence for over a generation after that bombing. Until the Roosevelt years, it was completely ineffective.
And as you say, going back to there are no heroes here, I looked at this book on a number of levels, and obviously with the terror today and what they're claiming to do in the NSA and everything else, you can see lots of political comparisons and all that. But where I was looking at the birth of the Industrial Revolution, which was really a paradigm shift in civilization. And I can't find a white knight, a winning player here, because as people swarmed to the cities for the jobs were plentiful. Well, that was good. The working conditions were horrendous. On the other hand, immediately gangs of thugs appeared, and mobs, if you will, in the forms of unions to, quote unquote, protect. And for the most part, this protection was for their own aggrandizement. And some of them certainly were dedicated socialists or even Marxists. But for the most part, I think it was probably a little baser than that, but you don't have great players. Now, what do you think was the union mentality? If you scratched the surface and got under it, what were they? Do you think they were really socialists, or were they just out for their own gain?
Oh, no, I don't think that they were basically socialists.
No.
They were doing what unions do today. They try to increase wages and try to increase benefits, and that was all they were after. I don't think that there were any radical socialists involved in the union movement in Los Angeles. There was a socialist running for mayor of the city at that time, but he was a moderate and rejected by the radicals mostly. I mean, it was. A very impressive loss that this man took. He had been the leading candidate to win the mayoral race. He had won the primary election, a guy named Job Harriman,
right,
who had actually run as a vice presidential candidate under the socialist ticket. But, you know, he was not a radical in the terms that the communists were a decade later. You know, this was 7 years before the Russian Revolution, and the country had not become as radical as it did, 10 years later. There was a bombing in 1920, or at least an explosion in 1920, that occurred on Wall Street. 38 people were killed, and over 200 people were injured. To this day, people don't know for sure who, if anyone, set that bomb. It could have been an explosion that was caused by a load of dynamite being taken to a construction site. But the result of that was that thousands of socialists, communists, anarchists were loaded on ships and deported. That was the Red Scare. But that was 3 years after the communist revolution in Russia. And things had changed a great deal by then.
And that was not, as far as I know, that was not tied to unionization or workers' groups in any way, was it? Were they fingering anybody in particular with the unions?
Yeah, the bombing on Wall Street?
Yeah.
They were communists and anarchists.
Right. Yeah, so that was more of a political thing, I would think. Now, it's interesting because I initially thought, all right, like you had just said, that the unions were out for better conditions and better wages for their workers. But to me, it became very bastardized along the way when you have people like Herbert Hocking or even J.J. McNamara. These guys, it seemed like, were more, obviously everybody's in it for themselves, but that there was an overtone of this that was more about control and the money from the workers than protecting the workers.
Well, to some extent, I don't think that J.J. McNamara made a lot of money doing all of this. I think that he was a pretty dedicated union guy, you know. But he was a little nuts. I mean, he had a plan to destroy the entire city of Los Angeles.
Right.
I think you made a notice in the book that at one point he proposed that he send a group of thugs out to Los Angeles, bomb the water sources in the city, then set fires all over the city, and then really bring the city down to its knees. And, he was a madman.
Clearly. But you're right. I would give him a certain amount of dedication there, too, which made him even crazier. As I say, I had some sympathies for Orty McManigle. J.B. McNamara, I don't know if you intended this, but you had me hating him from start to finish. I just did not like this guy. And was that the plan you wrote the book?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good. Well, because you succeeded.
I think he was a despicable human being, you know. it's really interesting that, I mean... Yeah, you know, Orty McManigle set off 150 bombs all over the country. I mean, probably the biggest serial bomber in terrorist in the history of the United States. But I did have some sympathy for this poor guy who had no way of getting out of it. I mean, he would have lost his life if he had tried to get out of this deal. You know, he's a very sympathetic character, I think.
I do too.
I didn't have any feeling like that about J.B. McNamara. I mean, he, from beginning to end, from his entire life was, he was a sociopath.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I was rooting for the death penalty on this guy by the end. Just did not care for JB at all. But the other side of this that was fascinating to me was the Clarence Darrow involvement, because I guess we've heard over the years something about, you know, his final trial and his support of labor. But this was truly a fiasco for him.
Oh, yes. I got into this book to begin with, as you know, when I interviewed Irving Stone, who wrote a fictional biography of Clarence Darrow. And Darrow comes off as a great white knight in that book. And he was not. And that was really disappointing to me. When I read these, especially his second trial, let me back up again. Darrow came to California to defend the dynamiters, J.B. McNamara and J.J. McNamara, who was also brought to California as the man who instigated the bombings. But Darrow knew from the very beginning that these guys were guilty and yet took money, you know, thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars from the union workers to take on the case, convinced that one way or another he was going to get them off. He certainly was not going to let two men die for a cause. And he would have done anything to do that. And he knew, however, that the other side would have done anything to make sure that they hanged. So at one point, when it became obvious that there was nothing else he could do, he decided to bribe the jurors and ultimately was arrested and had to stand trial here in California twice. And that wrecked his career. We talk about the problems that the unions had, but from 1910 until 1924, when Darrow defended Leopold and Loeb and the Scopes, and was involved in the Scopes case, he was out. He was in the wilderness.
And in some ways, or maybe in all ways, rightfully so, I was, and I'm not terribly naive, but I was stunned when I got to the part that he was suborning perjury, that he was trying to bribe jurors, that he was, this guy would stop at nothing. And this is, when you normally hear the words Clarence Darrow, you do not think of a guy who's going out to bribe the jurors. And that was stunning to me, that that part of his legacy hasn't lived on.
Well, it has. I mean, there were two excellent biographies of Darrow that were released just in the past year. And both of them, he does not come out very well in either one of them. I think that the more people look into Darrow's double dealings during his career, the more they realize that this guy was not the great hero that he's made out to be.
Now, the other attorney that was also a surprise to me is I was completely unaware that there was an Earl Rogers, let alone that he was the prototype, if you will, the inspiration for Perry Mason.
Oh, yes. This guy was probably the most celebrated lawyer in the United States, you know, despite the fact that he was based here in Los Angeles. He did so many interesting things in the courtroom that he became, a hero to many would-be lawyers. He had this guy, Jerry Giesler, working for him. Giesler became probably the attorney to the stars during the 1930s and 40s and 50s. And Giesler worshipped Earl Rogers. The only problem that Rogers had was that he was a drunk, and he died a very early death as an alcoholic. His daughter, incidentally, Adela Rogers St. John's, became a very famous newspaper woman in her own right.
Yeah.
And you may have seen her in the movie Reds. She was all the way through that that film.
Yeah, and lived into the 80s, and I knew who she was, had no idea about her father, and then also, the little I did know, had no idea of fall down drunk, and to imagine somebody who was that influential, truly, and that motivating to people like Jerry Giesler and many others, to, at the same time, being half out of his mind on alcohol, tells you the kind of charisma and abilities that this guy obviously had. Lou Irwin is my guest. The book is Deadly Times, the 1910 bombing of the Los Angeles Times and America's Forgotten Decade of Terror. I've got a link on Raleigh.net for a good price at Amazon, or I'm sure it's in your local bookstore as well. If you do have questions, I'll take them. 610-640-6400. Otherwise, I don't mind hogging Lou. I got plenty to talk about. And as I say, for a couple days, John was saying to me, "You putting that book down?" Like, no, I'm getting through it. And it was so easy. And really, it was a great book. Just great. It was a pleasure to read it. And thank you for writing it. So we'll pick it up right there. And I'm not one to walk around with a book, truth be known. So that's quite the compliment to Lou. So Deadly Times and more. Maybe your calls coming up on The Raleigh James Show. Alibaba, Alibaba.
It's the Raleigh James Show.
Breaking up big rocks on the chain gang. Breaking rocks and saving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang. Cause I've been convicted of crime. Hold a steady right there while I hit it. I reckon that all the kids been working.
Yeah!
And working.
Yeah!
But I still got so terrible long to go.
I commit the crime, Lord, of needin'. Crime of being hungry and poor. Left the grocery store, man, a-feedin'.
When he caught me robbing the store. Hold a steady right there while I hit it.
Well, I reckon that all the
been working,
yeah,
and working,
yeah,
but I still got so terrible long to go.
Out of her car and on your radio, it's the Empress of the Interstates, Raleigh James. Call Raleigh at 888-876-5593, 8888-RALEIGH.
I heard that you're 5 years late.
And I hope you will. My guest is Lou Irwin. Deadly Times is the book. It is worth the read. Of course, if I was going to have somebody on, I'd certainly skim through their work, no doubt about that. But if nothing else, out of politeness. The difference here is I read it cover to cover, and it was one revelation after another. And again, for somebody who is an Angeleno, and for somebody who I fancy myself as having a pretty good grip historically, and to miss the bombing of the Los Angeles Times, that's huge. And there are so many implications of this. Clearly, there was initially in Los Angeles and in the labor movement for a couple decades thereafter, but more as well. And we'll get back to Lou Irwin in a moment. Wanted to mention the Sea Crane Company, though. And if you're listening to the show, well, you're listening to it online. There's absolutely no other way. Do you have a Wi-Fi radio? That's the hot ticket. What I love about Wi-Fi radios is they kind of include the experience that radio always was back in the day with all of the choice that you have online right now. The CC Wi-Fi looks like a radio, feels like a radio. It's got buttons, knobs, clock, alarm, timer, and all that good stuff. A remote control, too, by the way, which is neat. All you need to bring to the table is a broadband internet connection with a wireless access point, and the CC Wi-Fi does the rest. Literally over 16,000 stations from which to choose and growing. It's small, it's compact, it'll fit right by your nightstand for late night listening. I use it as my clock. I use the pillow speaker, actually, so I put it under the pillow and then I can be there all night, depending on if I'm trying to go to sleep. Well, there are choices for that, as well as things to be entertained or actually even enlightened. All the things that radio isn't today, radio still is online, and you can have it all on the CC Wi-Fi. If you go to ccrane.com, and there's a link right at raleigh.net, right on the homepage, you can link right through. You can take a look at the CC Wi-Fi, see everything about it, or if you'd like to talk to them, unlike everything else you'll order online with the CC Wi-Fi, you're talking to them right in Fortuna, California, right in the office. So don't call now, they're home. But if you call tomorrow during business hours, they'll answer the phone and they'll answer all your questions. This is real customer service like it was back in the day with products that are just up to the moment. The phone number is 888-444-7993, 888-444-7993, or, as I say, go to raleigh.net, and there's a link for the Sea Crane Company. If you mention James, you get a 5% discount on your whole order, so you can't beat that. But if you want to hear this show or anything else, there's no easier or better way to do it than with a Wi-Fi radio, and there's no better Wi-Fi out there than the CC Wi-Fi from the Sea Crane Company. You tell them Raleigh sent you, you'll save some money. All right, we're talking to Lou Irwin. Fascinating work, Deadly Times, the 1910 bombing of the Los Angeles Times, and America's Forgotten Decade of Terror. And it is it's fascinating on so many levels, Lou, but one of the major players that we haven't mentioned yet, William Burns, a name we hear today, of course, start of the FBI and everything else, but in many ways, he made his career in this case, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, he was known, he had a reputation as the American Sherlock Holmes,
right,
before the investigation of the bombing. Gosh, this case really made his reputation. And yes, it also made him a lot of money. And yes, he became the first head of the FBI, and ultimately started the Burns Agency, and you still see his name on the badges of on the badges of guards all over the country.
Oh, sure. And I think when I was trying to get into the minds of all the players, to me, he was probably the most straight up of them, and also the guy with the goods. He knew what he was going to do. He was going to go after and get these people. He did. He delivered what he said. And while I wouldn't call him, quote unquote, a white knight, I think he was probably the most stand-up player in the group. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's a good assessment, I think. You know, he comes off pretty clean in all of this.
Yeah.
Everybody thought that he was trying to frame the McNamaras. And but in the end, he was proved right on almost every level.
Yeah. He was great. And when you mention frame the McNamaras, I think maybe more than anything else, that's why Harriman lost the mayoral election, because he was really trumpeting that that was going on. And suddenly when they confessed, it made him look like a fool.
Oh, yes. And he had no idea that the confession was coming. I mean, it was just a complete shock to him when the McNamaras confessed to in court that they were indeed guilty. And, people all over the city were wearing buttons, Harriman buttons, and wearing buttons that with J. McNamara's picture on them saying, kidnapped,
yeah.
Framed, you know? And, the day that they confessed, there were thousands of buttons all over the street. It was a disappointment on a lot of levels to union workers in the city, and above everyone else, poor Joe Perelman.
Now, I don't doubt for a minute that the bulk of the union workers probably were surprised, if not stunned, on the confession, because I think most of them were very well-intentioned and believed that their men were being framed. But I wondered about Harriman, and I never really did get a clear picture of that. Do you think he knew they were guilty?
I think that everybody who was involved in that case knew that they were guilty. The evidence was just so overwhelming. I mean, Darrow at one point said to the to the dynamiters, "I mean, you left a trail a mile wide." And they did.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing number of errors that these guys made all along the route. You know, they couldn't have drawn more attention if they had written on the walls, "I'm the guy who did it," you know? It's just an amazing number of blunders from beginning to end.
Do you think that their success in the Midwest, particularly Ordy's success, but in general, they'd been doing so many of these, and it had been, again, almost open and shut, bomb the place, sign them up as a union, everything's fine. Do you think that maybe they expected this to be a lot easier in terms of not being found out than it was?
Well, I think that Ordy McMadigal was thinking all along, "I'm going to be caught any day."
Yeah, right.
Poor guy, he really thought that the this couldn't last. And in the end, you know, the guy had no choice but to sign a confession that otherwise he knew that he was going to be goners.
Well, you know, I got the idea if they had sent Ordy out there instead of J.B. that we might still be wondering who bombed the Times. J.B. was such a bumbling guy on top of everything else that they did leave a trail of evidence that not only would stun Darrow, but anybody who was looking at it. But regardless, it came out the way it did, and the implications were really long-lasting, as you say.
I agree that Ordy McMadigal would have been able to have gotten away with this. But the thing is that Ordy McMadigal would never have set a bomb in a building with human beings in it.
Right.
He would never have done it. He was trapped. He knew that he was trapped. But he was still going to do whatever he could to prevent human life from being taken by what he did. And he worried all the time that there might be some accident, that some guy would come wandering along at the, just at the time the bomb went off, and that he would kill him. And that concerned him all along. He set off 150 bombings, as I said, but only a few injuries, and none of those very serious.
Right, and all of them affected him greatly. Now, he was a very sympathetic character that way, and, of course, it was odd, and you got to read the book to find out how, but it was odd how he got roped into this in the first place. He certainly wasn't out there because he had an axe to grind with anybody. He was just stuck in this, and did a heck of a job as far as that goes. Now, when we talk about Ordy, it's not possible not to bring up Herbert Hocking. And this was another guy, and I'm sure you intended it, because, man, you made me hate him.
Yeah, I depicted him as the as outright evil. You know?
Right, absolutely.
There was nothing that this guy did that was good. I mean, from being involved sexually with kids at one point, you know, to ratting on the dynamiters ultimately, and then taking over the job of J.J. McNamara as the Secretary Treasurer of the Union, and then writing him all kinds of very nice notes about what was going on and how they were all rooting for him and all of that. I mean, the guy was just an incredibly evil guy.
Yeah, he absolutely. You got me against him with the first paragraph on this guy, and it continued. And when you're talking about Los Angeles compared to San Francisco, that's very interesting to me as well, that San Francisco, a very closed city, was not experiencing the growth that Los Angeles was to any degree. Now, between the period of time, say 1911, and the quote-unquote Great Depression, how were the trajectories of both those cities? Did Los Angeles continue to grow as an open shop? Did unionization start to get a handle, or was it not until after we were really in economic destitution that that took place?
Well, unions were always behind San Francisco. Until rarely, fairly recently, the LA Times was still an open shop outfit. You know, and the unions have never really made the kind of mark in Los Angeles as they have in other major cities in the country. And partly because of the opposition of the Los Angeles Times all along. Los Angeles began growing primarily because of the weather, I think.
Right.
It was by the time the Second World War came along and all of the war manufacturing
sure.
companies took root in Los Angeles, it just became, well, the second largest city in the United States.
Sure, and the film industry, it didn't hurt, glamorized it, and then a lot of the returning World War II vets who settled in Southern California, you could see that happening. But it's interesting because when you're not aware that California is not a right-to-work state, you would normally think that Los Angeles would have fairly quickly been a very closed town, and it's really not to this day, is it?
No, you're absolutely correct. It's still, the unions are still relatively weak in Los Angeles.
You know, interestingly, maybe the strongest unions are things like the DGA, unions that are in the entertainment industry compared to others. And of course, Los Angeles compared to some cities, not the stranglehold on manufacturing that others do. But you mentioned the defense industry. There is manufacturing. There's oil refining. There's other things. Why do you think, because I'm sure people have tried to organize in Los Angeles, why do you think that it hasn't become more successful?
Well, I'm no expert on union management. I really don't know. You mentioned the DGA. I mean, it's hard even to think of the DGA as a union. I mean, here is an organization probably with every member making over $1 million, I'll bet. you know, it's the motion picture industry is an anomaly, I think. And I think that the unions involved in the motion picture industry are as well. People make tens of thousands of dollars for doing nothing in the industry, you know.
Well, there absolutely is that. But I do know some DGAers who are network employees who are probably making closer to $50,000 a year than $5 million. But we talk very often because some of the other unions are becoming weaker and weaker. You were in radio all those years. You know radio today compared to how it was. You would normally think that this would be the ripest ground for collective bargaining. And if anything, it's gone completely the other way. So we're at a different point now economically, but certainly far fewer jobs today than there were, yet there doesn't seem to be the employees embracing any form of collective bargaining. And just on a sociological aspect, I find that interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I, as I say, I'm not any sort of expert on that, but yes. Definitely an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not claiming one way or another right or wrong. It just seems to me that when you look at the history of union organizing, and to an extent, your book is written at a time when this really was truly the beginning of that in many ways, you would think, okay, well, now the seeds right now are perfectly set for it, and yet we're at a time when, never mind what the employer is doing, the employee isn't embracing it. And sometimes I wonder, and this goes back to some of the premise in your book of No White Knights, sometimes I wonder if people look at it and say, well, they're not going to represent me anyway. The idea that there's no faith in that process. And to an extent, when you read Deadly Times, like I say, you don't have faith in any of these players.
Yeah. That's really the tragedy of the whole story.
Right, and it's also the stunning aspect of the times to think about it, and maybe that's exactly where we are right now. It's certainly true in the political process. Anybody who has been an adherent to either of the parties, I think, feels very let down when they look at the results. Doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on, your bottom line reaction is these people don't represent me. And I sometimes wonder if that's not where, rightly or wrongly, where union activity is today. Where we are in some ways the polar opposite of sentiment, though in terms of the actual occurrences, maybe exactly where we were in 1910.
May very well be. Yeah. May very well be. I mean, that's a very interesting observation.
It's a fascinating book, as I say. Now, when you were writing it, it had to be a mite depressing to continue to realize that there are no real heroes in here. And other than Earl Rogers, who was quite the character, was there any other aspect where you looked at it and you said, yeah, I really could get behind this person or this movement? Was there anything that was really clean? And we talked about Burns, of course, but in general, anything that gave us some hope?
I don't think so, but you know, I had to cut out about 30,000 words from this book because just to make it economically publishable, and I had to cut out a lot of stuff about Earl Rogers, who was a very fascinating character in his own right. I mean, I could write a book on Earl Rogers himself. There's one story that's not in the book that I wish were about his defending a guy named Griffith L. Griffiths. And he was a developer in Los Angeles and worth many millions of dollars. And he got involved in an argument with his wife, shot her in the eye, and she ran to the window, jumped out the window, and an awning below her saved her life. Well, he was arrested, stood trial, and Earl Rogers defended him.
Oh, no.
And got him off.
Oh, no.
When the trial was over, Griffith approached Rogers and said, I'm going to give you a huge amount of land in appreciation for what you did for me. And Rogers said, you scum, give it to the city. And that's how Griffith Park was born.
As soon as you said Griffith, I was thinking, oh, no, Griffith Park. Well, and, you know, isn't that interesting? Because something you did bring up about Rogers in the book is he did believe that everybody was entitled to a defense. And clearly he was acting on his principles, defending this guilty guy. But in the end, he really was the hero to say, give it to the city. Bet his daughter was bet his daughter was sorry about that part.
I think that Rogers was very well off by the time he died. But you know, be that as it may, the man was a very fascinating character, very fascinating. Yeah, and you know, he was a very handsome guy too,
yeah.
And was won a lot of the cases simply because of his huge charisma in the courtroom. He looked, I mean, the spitting image of Leonardo DiCaprio. There's a picture of him in the book.
Yes.
And it's just amazing how the resemblance there.
I agree. Even the Wikipedia picture, when you're online looking at that, it is very close and amazing that, you know, that it's so close. It's interesting, too, the charisma, because that seems not only in Deadly Times, but to be the theme all throughout history, that those who are the most charismatic seem to win. But many times those people have a dark underside that you say, this is a sociopath. But with Earl Rogers, he was very charismatic, but underneath it all, he had morals. He didn't use it to that kind of a negative self-aggrandizing extent. And of course, what did he get for it? He was stone-cold alcoholic. Do you have any insight into what his personal demons were?
No, but you know, we're talking about a time when people drank a lot. Alcohol was the television of the day. At one point, I said in the book, I said that it was, you know, a recreational drug, and that and Rogers engaged in a lot of recreation. he was not. I don't think that you can compare a drunk in those days to a drunk these days, because everybody was drinking. It was something that men did in those days.
Now, I don't think it came out in the book, but I believe he was the son of a Methodist minister. So when I look at it that way, I say, man, and drinking like that. But you're right. It sociologically was acceptable then, but it would be a fascinating study to know a little more about him. But I guess if there were any white knight in the story, it is maybe it is him, though, like you say, in Deadly Times, it's start to finish. You don't come away really rooting for any side in this matter. It's a wonderful read.
But, you know, he was the one who wrote the law that kind of precipitated the bombing in any case. He wrote the law that prevented picketing in Los Angeles. And that really ticked off the unions more than anything else. And, you know, there were hundreds of people who were arrested in Los Angeles for picketing and put in jail. And
right.
Couldn't make a living for their families just because they were picketing for better wages.
Well, you're bringing up something there that really almost is a whole other book, or certainly another hour of talking to you, and that's that when you do shut down someone's freedom of expression, the results may be explosive. And very often today, with political correctness and speech that's being prohibitive and people being afraid to share their sentiments, I wonder if it isn't going to escalate into more terror. So that's a great maybe way to punctuate why it's important to read and understand Deadly Times. I can't believe it. The hour.
You know, there was a story that I also had to edit out of the book. A fire that occurred at Fox Television, and in the after at Fox News rather, and in the aftermath of that, there was a story about what occurred in one of the. I think Newsmax, or one of the liberal sites,
mm-hmm.
And people underneath that wrote, you know, those people should have been killed. Too bad the whole building didn't burn down. all of this sort of stuff. I read that and I thought, God, this could happen today.
Oh, it absolutely
could. Have enough nuts. There are enough nuts around to burn down Fox News.
Right.
Oh, not that I'm expressing any kind of sympathy for Fox News. But
no.
You understand?
Absolutely. No, I get that. But you're 100% right, and I think we're probably more prone to it when people don't feel that they are able to express their opinions. And it's ironic because today, with the internet and other sources, there are more avenues to do so. But the idea that this was over 100 years ago now, the one thing that doesn't change, and you know it so well, Lou, is human nature. We really haven't moved that far.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a wonderful book. Thank you for writing it, and thanks for spending an hour with us.
Well, thank you for asking me to be on your show. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Terrific. Well, I hope you'll write another one, and I hope to be the one to interview you about that as well. And maybe some night you can come back and we'll talk about Earth News Radio.
I'd love to do that.
All right. Thanks, Lou.
Thank you, Raleigh.
All right. Deadly Times, the 1910 bombing of the Los Angeles Times and America's forgotten decade of terror. Lou Irwin. There is a link on Raleigh.net right on the homepage to buy the book. I think it will open your eyes in a number of ways. And as I say, also put you in that place to realize that human nature doesn't change.
It's the Raleigh James Show.